Okay, I want to start with something that I know I've spoken about in the past. I don't know how far in the past. And there are new faces here, so you didn't hear it. And the people who have heard it haven't heard it from me as many times as I have, so it doesn't make a difference. Every yeshiva bocher, everybody who learns Gemara, Daf Yomi, knows that we derive one, at least, of the methods of marriage, how a marriage is affected, from this week's Sedra. The Torah says, Ki yikach ish isha, a man will take a woman. Now, it doesn't say specifically how that taking is. Maybe he has to club her over the head and drag her into a cave or whatever, and that's the way to take a woman. So what does it mean, Ki yikach ish isha? So the Gemara says that when God gave the Torah, he placed similar words sometimes in different places to tell me that the law in one place applies in another place. That's called the Gzeres Shaveh. It's one of the 13 principles that was given along with the Torah, how to learn things out of the Torah. In this week's Sedra, Avram Avinu buys the field of Machpelah and Ma'aras HaMachpelah, the cave, for burying Sarah. And there he gives money, buys the cave with money. And the Torah uses the terminology, Kesef HaSadeh Kach Mimeni, take the money for the field. So the Gemara says, we learn, Kicha Kicha Misdei Ephraim. Here it says, Ki Yikach Ish Isha, a man will take a woman. Here it says, take the money. We learn that the way, one of the ways of taking a woman in marriage is by giving money. That, and that's what we do. Money doesn't only mean money, it means anything of value. So the minig is to give a ring, but really anything that's a shavah pruta, anything that's worth a minimal amount of money would affect that wedding. If the man gives the woman something of value in front of two kosher witnesses, then that affects a marriage. That's how we learn it out. There are those that would want to detract and speak derogatorily about the Torah. And they say, you see, that the Torah, or the rabbis, considered marriage like a real estate deal. You buy a field, buy a wife. Right? The Torah compares the two. Avram bought a field for something worth money, and marriage is affected the same way, so it seems that a woman is like buying a field. Buy a field, buy a wife, it's all a transaction. And that seems to reduce a woman to a piece of dirt, like a field. So why isn't it like that? What's the answer to that? Right. The real answer is the Torah is not equating buying a field with marrying a woman. It's only that we learn the two words here and there that they're the same concept, but not that the two places in the Torah have the same concept. But in any case, but people who want to detract from the Torah say, you see, they learned marriage from a real estate transaction. Seemingly there's some kind of connection between them, and that's a problem. So let me tell you, not only is this not a question, not only is it not something negative and derogatory, but this is exactly what marriage is all about, if you understand what went on with Avraham Avinu. In order to understand it, we're going to have to give a few prefaces, and it's going to be a little complicated, but if you stay on the train till the end, I think that's an interesting idea, and you'll see that in the end, not only is this not a question, but this is the best place to learn what marriage is all about. Start with another question. We're going to explain this beginning of the Sedra in great detail. The Torah goes to great detail to tell us how Avraham Avinu bought Ma'aras HaMachpelah. All the details, back and forth, what he said, what the other one said. The Rishonim are bothered by that, because the Torah doesn't go into great detail in a lot of things. You could have said it in one sentence. Avram bought the cave of Machpelah and buried Sarah there. Who cares how exactly what he said, what the other one said, how they bought it? Why is the Torah so verbose over here, out of character? Well, the Torah is usually very concise. So there are all different answers to this question. For instance, the Ramban says that it comes to tell me the importance of Kever Avos, that we should know that it's a mitzvah, kibud av va'em, to visit a parental grave site. And therefore the Torah went to great detail to tell me how Avram Avinu bought Maris Machpelah. We should know how important it is. Others say that it comes to tell me that Avram Avinu was a great person. You see how they dealt with him, and they called him the Prince of God, and that God's promise to Avram that I'll make you great was fulfilled. Okay, the Ibn Ezra says another thing. The Ibn Ezra says the following. He says that it comes to tell me that Avram Avinu spent a lot of time and effort and money in securing this burial plot for his wife, to tell me how important Eretz Yisrael is for the living and the dead. You see that Avram Avinu was willing to go to bother and expense to bury Sora Imenu in Eretz Yisrael. So Eretz Yisrael must be pretty important. It's worth the effort and the expense to be buried in Israel. It's not only beneficial to the living, it's even beneficial to the dead. That's the Ibn Ezra. The Ramban asks a very simple question on this Ibn Ezra. He says, I agree with you that Eretz Yisrael is very special for the living and the dead, but you can't learn it from here. Because where did Sara Imenu die? In Eretz Yisrael. So of course Avraham Avinu buried her where she died. If Sara Imenu had died in Borough Park, and Avram went to an expense and bother to bring her body to Eretz Yisrael, then you would know this idea. But you usually bury people where they die. So from the fact that Avram Avinu buried Sara Imenu in Eretz Yisrael, and she died in Eretz Yisrael, is no proof that Eretz Yisrael is anything special. He buried her where she died. So that's where he went, to the expense. And she died in Timbuktu, he would have buried her in Timbuktu. Where do you see, says the Ramban, that Eretz Yisrael is special because Avram buried her in Eretz Yisrael? That's where she died. What? So, yeah, fine, but not here. You're here, you don't see it. So, the Ibn Ezra says that's why the Torah went to such details over here to tell you this law. The Ramban says, I don't understand what he's talking about. How do you see that over here? In order to understand this Ibn Ezra, I want to start with another thing. A question on a Ramban. The Ramban says, and we're not going to go into detail why that is, just we'll see what he says. He says that before the Torah was given, basically the mitzvos only applied in Eretz Yisrael. And that's why the avos kept the mitzvos voluntarily before the Torah was given, but only when they were in Eretz Yisrael. When they left Eretz Yisrael, they didn't necessarily keep the Torah. Therefore, he says, that explains how Yaakov Avinu could marry two sisters. Torah prohibits marrying two sisters, right, during their lifetime. So you can only marry a sister after the other one dies, if you were married to the first sister. But to be married to two sisters who are alive, that is awesome. So, says the Ramban, the Avos only kept the Torah voluntarily in Eretz Yisrael. Outside of Eretz Yisrael, they didn't keep it. Therefore, Yaakov Avinu, when he was outside of Eretz Yisrael, in Aram Narayim by Lavan, married two sisters. No problem. Torah wasn't given yet, and he didn't voluntarily keep it except in Eretz Yisrael. And that, says the Ramban, is the reason why Rachel Imenu died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael, that he shouldn't be married to two sisters in Eretz Yisrael. Wow, good question. So the obvious question on this Ramban is, let's see clearly, who is buried in Kever Rachel? No? Kever Rachel. Who's buried in Kever Rachel? Very good, right? Who's buried in Grant's tomb? Right? I'm not, you don't trust me, I see. The who's buried in Kever Rachel? Rachel. Where is Kever Rachel? In Beis Lechem. Where is Beis Lechem? In China? It's in Eretz Yisrael, right? So what does the Ramban say, that Rachel died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael? So Yaakov would not be married to two sisters in Eretz Yisrael when Rachel died where she's buried in Beis Lechem. She's buried where she died, on the road. And that is Eretz Yisrael. So what's the Ramban saying? She died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael. It's clear that Rachel died in Eretz Yisrael. That's the question.
She was guilty already when she did the Tarafim and lied, and then her faith was sealed.
Fine, but she wasn't dead. Right? Still, Yaakov was married to her. She was still kicking. Right? So that was still prohibited. It only became permitted to be married to Leah when Rachel died. And Rachel didn't die till they came back to Eretz Yisrael. So what the Ramban says is that she died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael is not true.
Maybe he meant she was going to die.
I understand, but a sister who's going to die is still also to be married to her. He's just saying that it was okay. God didn't want Yaakov to transgress the prohibition of being married to two sisters in Eretz Yisrael, so therefore Rachel died before. The fact that she was liable to die before didn't make it any better that he was married to two sisters. In order to answer this, there's a Chassam Sofer, which here you needed a little bit more information. That's the following. This land has many names. Eretz HaKodesh, the Holy Land. It sometimes was called Eretz Canaan, because that's the people who were occupying it, the Canaanim. When is it called Eretz Yisrael? When it is owned by Jews, by Klal Yisrael. That's when it becomes Eretz Yisrael. It was not Eretz Yisrael in the beginning, because there was no Yisrael here. It was Eretz HaKodesh, Eretz HaSkula, many other names, Eretz HaChayim, but not Eretz Yisrael. When did it become Eretz Yisrael for the first time? When Yehoshua conquered it. When he conquered it, it became Eretz Shel Yisrael, the land now conquered and owned by the Jewish people. When we went into Golis, according to some opinions, it wasn't ours anymore for that 70 years. Somebody else took it over, Bavel. And it wasn't Eretz Yisrael anymore for certain laws. Certain laws depend on the intrinsic geographic place. When God created the world, he created a holy land. And this land is holy, whether it belongs to the Jewish people or not, for certain things. But for certain things, its holiness depends on it belonging to the Jewish people. For instance, if I plant something in the ground in this land, and it grows, I have to take off truma and maaser, you're all familiar, right? If you plant it in Miami, you don't have to take off anything. Right? Just eat it. There's no orla, orla is mineral abonim, but there's no truma and maaser and shmita and whatever. When do those laws apply? Only when this land belongs to Israel. Before we came and conquered the land, if somebody would have planted things here, doesn't have trumas and maaseres. It's holy for other reasons, but not for that. The agricultural holiness depends on it being belonging to the Jewish people, meaning that when we own the land, it elevates the holiness of the land. The land is holy, but it becomes more holy when we own it. And it becomes even more holy when most Jews live here, because certain laws only apply from the Torah when all Jews live in Eretz Yisrael. Most Jews live in Eretz Yisrael. And they live in the places they're supposed to live according to tribe. That Yovel, the Jubilee year, only applies when most Jews live here and they are living in the place that they're supposed to live. They know which tribe they belong to and they live in the place where it was divided up according to the tribes, which won't happen again until Mashiach comes. So therefore the laws of the Jubilee year don't apply. Not even rabbinically, the rabbis didn't make a rabbinic jubilee like they did by Shemitah. Doesn't apply. So what do you see? That as long as this land does not belong to the Jewish people, it's not called Eretz Yisrael. It's called something else, Eretz Canaan, Eretz HaKodesh, and it has a certain level of holiness, but that holiness is elevated and increased when it belongs to the Jewish people. In the time of Yaakov Avinu, what part of this land could rightfully be called Eretz Yisrael? Only one part, Hebron, because that Avram Avinu bought. It belonged to a Jew. If you say that Avram Avinu was considered a Jew, Right, that area, right? Not the whole Chevron. That's the field and Moris HaMachpel. That was Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Every place else was Eretz HaKodesh, wasn't Eretz Yisrael. That's exactly what the Ramban says. Rachel Imenu died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael. Yes, Beis Lechem was part of Eretz HaKodesh. Eventually it became part of Eretz Yisrael later on when Yoshua conquered it. But at that time it wasn't Eretz Yisrael. So where did she die? Before they came back to Hebron. Hebron had within it the part of Eretz Yisrael that could be called Eretz Yisrael, the part that Avraham Avinu bought. Otherwise, it wasn't Eretz Yisrael. And now we can go and see what the Ibn Ezra says. So that answers the Ramban. So it comes out that only a part that you owned by a Jew has the full mila, right, the full benefit of being Eretz Yisrael. And if you bury somebody in an area that doesn't belong to a Jew, in this land, right, before it belonged to Jews, didn't have the same kedusha, didn't have the same effect as a part that belonged to a Jew. Okay, now let's see what happened with Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu comes to the people of Chet and he says the following: Ger v'toshav anochi imochem, tnu li achuzas kever imochem. He says, I'm a stranger and a citizen. What does that mean? You're a stranger, you're a citizen. What are you? And why do you have to say that? And give me a achuzas kever, a burial plot. I mean, give me. Avraham Avinu is looking for presents. He should have said, sell me a burial plot. Why do you say, give me a burial plot? The Mishonim say the following. I'm giving you a little bit of this one, a little bit of this one together, and together it sounds even better than each one by himself. They say the following. In those days, there were two kinds of burial grounds in every city. There was what was called a family burial plot that was owned by the people of the city individually, and they buried their dead there year after year, generation after generation. Great grandparents were buried there, then grandparents, then parents, then the children, and then the next generation, and so on and so on. It was a family plot that was owned by the family, and they buried their dead in that place. It was their private cemetery. That was one kind. But as happens today even, many times people who didn't live in the city died in the city. They came visit. They were passing through. They were on business. And they died. In those days, for sure, they usually couldn't ship a body back to where he lived. It just was impossible. Okay? It was, even today, or even, what's it called, you can't always ship a body. Today it's easier. You have planes, whatever. But then it was very difficult. In fact, even in modern times, before World War I, Reb Lazer Gordon, the Tulsa Rosh Yeshiva, was collecting money for his yeshiva in England. And he had a very rough time. The people from England will excuse me. He had a very rough time. And he died there. They say he died of a broken heart because of how unsuccessful he was. And he had other tzaras there. He died in London. And he lived in Lithuania. That's where the yeshiva was. They didn't ship his body back to Lithuania. They buried him outside of London. He's buried. Blazer Gordon is buried outside. I was there. When one of my trips to England with my son, we went to see the kever. It's outside of London.
In London.
Huh?
In London.
In the London, but it's the outskirts. No? What?
Edmonton.
That's London?
Yes.
Okay. The whatever we drove quite a while from Golders Green to get there, so it's still London. It's London. The in any case, so they didn't ship his body back. They buried him where he died. Therefore, they had another kind of cemetery, public cemetery, where they buried people who died in the city who were not citizens of the city. They didn't own the land. The family did not own that land. It's just that they had burial rights to bury the deceased there. But no, the city owned the land. It was public property, belonged to this city, and they gave rights to people who died there to be buried there. but the family of that person had no claim on the land. They didn't own the land. Avraham Avinu comes to the people of Chet and he says the following. I'm an enigma over here. Because on the one hand, I'm not a citizen of your country. I'm a stranger. So you would tell me that you don't want to give me a family plot here because I don't own land. It's your city and I'm just a stranger here. But the truth is, I'm not a stranger because I'm going to own this land one day. It's given to me and it's my land. And my wife's going to be buried here till Tchias HaMeisim. So I want her to be buried in my land. So therefore, tenuli achuzas kever. I don't want her to be buried in a public plot. I want you to give me achuzas kever. Achuzas kever means a family plot. Now why do you say give me a family plot? Because land that's consecrated as burial land is sacrilegious to sell. You don't make profit, you don't do business with a family plot. It's sacrilegious. It's like selling your mother. You don't do that. So he said the following. I'm not going to ask you to sell me, do business with land that's consecrated to be cemetery land. Give it to me. Right? That you can do. You're doing me a favor. You're magnanimous people. And don't worry. We'll work out the money. Right? But it won't look like a sale because I don't want to put you in a position where you're going to look like mercenary people who sell sacred land. So give it to me, right? And don't worry, right? Shmoenu, listen to me, and against to them that if you look at the parasha, every other word is, listen, Shmoenu Adoni, Shmoenu Adoni, listen. What were they all hard of hearing? You have to say, listen, hear me. No, they're all talking in hints. Get what I'm hinting at, because we can't say this openly because it's not nice. We're talking about selling and buying burial land. You can't talk about that in a business way. We're going to have to talk about it in hints. So now they say, nothing doing. They answer him and they say, Shmoenu Adoni. You listen carefully, Avraham. Nisi Elokim, you're great, we really respect you. But B'mivchar Kvorenu Kvoris Meisecha. You can bury your dead in our land, not your land. We're not giving any land. We'll give you the rights of burial anywhere you want. You're an important person. You can bury your wife in our land. We're not giving you land. And the reason they hid behind that we don't do business with sacred land. We don't sell burial plots. Okay? We'll give you permission to bury in our land. We're not selling you our land. Avraham says, okay, that's not acceptable. I want my wife buried in the land that I own. We'll see one second why. But if you really want my... I'm not going to bury her in your land, so I decline the offer. But if you really want to help me, I know there's somebody amongst you who will sell his burial plot, his burial land. He would sell his mother. He would sell anything. Ephron. So you get me together with Ephron, and I'll work it out with him. Nope. Ephron sitting there, and Ephron says, what's it called... Avraham says to Ephron, right, please give me Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Again, give it to me. I wouldn't want you to look like you're selling sacred land. Bekesef Malei Titnenuli. And don't worry, I'll give you a present too. You're giving me a present, I'll give you a present. Money. Not a sale, right? You give me a present, I'll give you a present. Ephron doesn't like that idea. Why? Because if Avraham is giving him money as a present, Ephron can't decide how much money to give me as a present. He can't make a price, because we're not selling anything. I'm giving you a present, you're giving me a present. So you'll decide how much present you want to give me, and that's not acceptable. So Ephron says, you listen to me carefully, and I got another way of doing this. Forget about you give me a present, I'll give you a present, it looks nice. I have a better way. I'll give you the whole thing. The cave and the field. It's all yours. Avraham says, who's talking about a field? I only want the cave. I didn't say anything about a field. What are you telling me, field? Then Avraham gets the hint. The cave was at the end of the field. There was no way to get to that cave without going through the field. Ephron hints to Avraham the following. I can't sell you the cave. That's burial land. But the field before it is mine. And if you don't buy the field, You can't get to your burial cave unless you have a helicopter. They didn't have those in those days. So I'm giving you both, meaning you understand that if you don't get both, your cave is worthless because you can't get there. So Avram says, I get the hint. Nosati kesef hasadeh. Okay, let's forget about the cave. You're giving me that as a present. Let's talk about buying the field. Fields are buyable. I'll give you money for the field. How much do you want? Now you can make the price. Ephron says, what's 400 shekel between friends, which is about a few million dollars? Exorbitant amount. Now Avram Avinu knows he's stuck. If he wants the cave, he's going to get the cave for free. But he has no access to the cave unless he buys the field, and he wants millions of dollars for the field. So Avram gives him the millions of dollars, and he buries his wife. Why did Avram go to such effort and expense to buy that field? Because he wanted a piece of real estate? No. Because he wanted Ma'aras HaMachpelah to belong to him. Why? So it would be Eretz Yisrael. And it wouldn't be Eretz HaChiti. And from here, says the Ibn Ezra, we learn how precious Eretz Yisrael is to the living and the dead, not how precious this land is. How precious this land as being Eretz Yisrael is. More precious than just the Holy Land. But the Holy Land that belongs to a Jew is precious for the living and the dead. How do you know that? Because Avram Avinu could have gotten it for free if he didn't want it to be his. And he spent an exorbitant amount in order that it should be his, it should become Eretz Yisrael. That's the idea.
Okay, it bothers me that Avram didn't prepare for the possibility that he would, that his wife would predecease him. He had to wait till he died. She died before he starts looking for a burial place.
That's a good question. It could be that since the funeral homes didn't exist, they didn't have plans, you know, of pay as you go or before you go or whatever.
Or he wasn't settled properly.
Could be, I don't know. Or it could be that Sari Menu died before her time, could be, and he wasn't expecting her to die then. Okay, in any case, that's the Ibn Ezra. So we've answered the Ibn Ezra. Where do we see from here? That's how important Eretz Yisrael is from the bother that Avram put in. Not from the fact that he buried where he buried, but that he spent so much and it should belong to him. And he didn't just have her buried in somebody else's land. Because in order for it to be Eretz Yisrael, it had to belong to him. That's the case. So why did Avram buy this field? Because he wanted to buy some real estate? No. Because he wanted to elevate this area to the status of Eretz Yisrael. How do you do that? You bond the soul of the Jewish people, which at that time was Avram Avinu, to the soul of the land, and it says in the Torah, Vayokam Shnei Ephraim. Rashi says, Tkum Bahaisa L'Sada. The field was uplifted. How was it uplifted? Because it became Eretz Yisrael. Its status became greater. It now became not just Eretz HaKodesh, not Eretz Canaan. Now it was Eretz Yisrael. And now when he buried his wife there, she benefited from being buried in Eretz Yisrael. And the land benefited by belonging to Avram, that it became Eretz Yisrael. So it was a symbiotic relationship. Avram elevated the land, and now the land can benefit the person buried there or the person who's living there. So it worked both ways. The land is elevated and benefits the people, and the people elevate the land and benefit the land. Isn't that marriage? Marriage is two neshamas bonding where each one elevates and enhances the other. And that's exactly what happened here. This was not a mercenary real estate deal. Avram didn't need the field. He only needed the field in order that that area should belong to him and his wife should be buried in Eretz Yisrael. So the whole concept over here of giving money and bonding himself with the field and them both being elevated is exactly. You give a woman money, the two neshamas are bonded and each one elevates the other one and enhances the other one. That's exactly what marriage is. And this is the place to learn it because this is not a mercenary business deal. This is something completely different. This is the idea of bonding two souls together, each one affecting and elevating the other. That's exactly what marriage is. So that's why we learn it from here, because this is not a business deal. It's not a real estate deal. This is something else completely. Okay. Any questions on this? Then we'll go toward something else. And don't look for a connection between what I'm going to say now and what we said, because they have no connection. Just another part of the parasha. Okay. Torah says after this that Avraham Avinu decides now that now he gets the feeling that he's getting old. His wife died, and he's got to worry now about what's going to be after he leaves the world. So he decides, I've got to marry off my son. So he sends his trusty servant Eliezer to go find the shidduch. And he instructs him, do not go to the Knanim, who I live amongst, go to my family. So all the Mefarshim are concerned with, what in the world is Avram's family greater than the people he lives amongst? There were nice people, people he lives amongst. Eliezer was a nice guy. Right? He was a Talmud Chacham. He was from Canaan. So couldn't he find any other Eliezers? Eliezer said he had a daughter. When he married Eliezer's daughter? Why did he have to go to his family? Now, if his family were this exemplary, wonderful, frum family is one thing. His family were a bunch of idol worshippers. Right? Lovan Ho'arami, Besuel Ho'arami. These were cheats, liars, right? Scam operators. That's right. This is what's it called? This is like, great. I got to go to my family because they're really special people, right? What in the world did Avraham Avinu see in his family that was better than the people he lived amongst? So there are all different answers to this, and I want to tell you some of them and some of the problems with them and some of the answers. First, some say that it was nothing. Let's just say the Rashi says Canaan was cursed by Noah. Or Canaan, they had a curse on them. A curse is like a disease that is genetic, right? If you have a genetic disease in a family, you don't want to marry into that family because you're afraid that it's going to crop up in future generations, that the genetic disease is going to crop up in the children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren. So you stay away. What?
Why was Noah cursed?
Right. They were cursed because of what he did to Noah.
What?
According to some, he castrated Noah and made it that he couldn't have more children.
Cham or
Canaan? Cham or Canaan. It's a child. But since Canaan was the main child of Cham, and Cham, if it was Cham who did it, right, he had that disease that he created on himself, right, pagam, that blemish, it passed on now through his children. That was the curse. The curse was you did something cursed and it created a blemish that spiritually genetic is going to pass on from generation to generation. So they were cursed. So with all the nice things, it's still a genetic, spiritual genetic disease that the Canaanim had. Ultimately, the Canaanim were destroyed. We had a mitzvah to destroy them, men, women, and children, because they were the blight of the world. So, therefore, Avraham Avinu said, I could find very nice people amongst them, but they have this genetic, spiritual, genetic problem. I can't let my son marry one of them, because who's else going to happen in future generations, where the disease will come to the fore? May skip a generation or two, but it'll come to the fore later on. So, I can't have my son marry an Orr. Ein Orr Mistabik B'Borach. I'm blessed, they're cursed. Two don't go together. That's one answer. Second answer. Avraham Avinu did not want anyone to say that the reason he got Eretz Yisrael is because of the wife's side. He married a Canaanite. He married Canaanite, and the reason they got Eretz Yisrael because they inherited from the wife's side of what's it called, Yitzchak's wife. That's why they got Eretz Canaan, not because God gave them the land, but because they had a connection to it through the wife's side. Avraham didn't want anybody to make that if this land is given to us by God. We didn't get it through Canaan because we married into the family. Another answer. Third answer. There's really no difference between the Canaanim and Avram's family. The mile of Avram's family is they were far away. Avram said, if I take a girl from a family that I live amongst, she's going to go home to her parents for a Shabbos or for a Sunday or for whatever, right? And she's going to spend the Kratzmich with them and and what's it called, they're going to have a terrible influence over her and my son. But if I take it from a far away, my family far away, they're not around. So I'll influence the couple, not the in-laws. So Avraham Avinu was nothing special about his family except that the Milo was that they were far away. And these people he lived amongst, and they would have an influence on the couple. In other words, the Ran, one second, the Rav Sharon Shulfelher says a very nice thing. I don't know if it's his own or many times he takes it from others. He says like this, Avraham Avinu is going to have to influence some young lady to be to the level that she could be the wife of Yitzchak. Nobody's going to be on that level just by this. She's going to have to come into Avram's family, and they're going to educate her and elevate her or whatever. Be makariv. Okay. So why should he be makariv a stranger when he can makariv somebody from his family? If already you're being makariv somebody, right? Just like if you have to give tzedakah, your family comes before strangers. If you want to help somebody out spiritually, why not look to do it to your family rather than to strangers? I'm going to have to somehow be makariv some young woman, so why shouldn't it be for my family? So therefore, he sent to his family, knowing that he could do that favor to his family rather than to strangers first. The Ran says something that on the surface is very difficult to understand. He says like this. He says, Avram sent to his family because there was something special about his family and something negative about the people around him, the Canaanite. The people in his family, he said, served idolatry. But that is a sin of intellect. Intellectually, they made a mistake. They had false ideologies. They had false beliefs. Beliefs is something that you can change. You can educate somebody to change their beliefs. The Canaanim, on the other hand, had bad midos. They had bad character. Bad character is something that goes from generation to generation. It's in the blood. And that doesn't necessarily mean that if the parents had bad character, the children are going to for sure have that bad character. But it's there. It can be uprooted. It can skip a generation. But it's in the genes spiritually. Bad character, says the Ran, passes from generation to generation. Every generation can control it, can uproot it, but it's there. And if you don't do something about it, you're going to have the same bad character that your parents had or grandparents had or whatever. You can do something about it. But if you don't, it's there. But bad beliefs don't get passed on genetically. Those are something that's just intellectual. So you can train somebody to change their beliefs. That is what the Ran says. There's only one problem, yeah?
The same thing you said about the Mitzrim? Why not the Mitzrayim?
Yeah, could be. Same thing. Mitzrim, right. They have bad character traits. There's only one problem. Comes from the Ran that the only problem with Yaakov's, with Avram's family, Lavan and Bethuel, was that they were idol worshippers. But otherwise, they had impeccable character. Okay, I don't know who the Ran was thinking about. Lavan Ho'arami, right? The Torah calls him Ramal, the cheat, the faker, the liar. That doesn't sound like somebody with great character. Sounds like they're really miserable characters. So, but look what he did to Yaakov Avinu, Lavan. Bethuel wanted to kill Eliezer. These are what, just idol worshippers, or these are people who don't have nice characters? So I hear what the Ran is saying, but how does it apply to Lavan and Bethuel that they were character-wise okay, just they were idol worshippers? So I think the simple answer could be character can come from two places. You can have a rotten character, and because of that, you have rotten beliefs. What you believe emanates from your bad character, or the opposite. You can have bad beliefs, and that leads you to develop bad character traits. The Ran said like this, Avram knew that his family's bad character came from their bad beliefs. And since you can change beliefs, that kind of character you can change too. But the Canaanim, their bad character was the foundation. That led them to their bad beliefs. Then the foundation is the bad character. But I have a better answer. That's one possible answer. I was thinking of a better answer, and that's the following. What are we referring to by bad character traits that can be passed on from generation to generation? Doesn't mean just any kind of bad character trait. Let's speak about good character traits. A person is has good character, and we say, well, he's not a thief. He's an honest person, he's not a thief. Who deserves to have that praise that he's not a thief? Somebody who hasn't stolen? Maybe, maybe not. Let me tell you why that may not be true. Let's take a person who hasn't stolen anything. He's never stolen, never shoplifted, he never stole anything, never took anything that's not his. What would be, though, if he would be in the following situation? He's alone in a room with a multimillionaire who's senile. He carries around $10,000 as small change in his pocket. That means nothing to him. That $10,000 is like 10 agurot to you. He just carries it around just in case he may need it. Right? It's a wad of $10,000 bills. Carries it in his pocket. That's his change purse. If he loses that $10,000, he'll never know the difference. He has a million times that, right? He has no children. He has no dependents. He is filthy rich with no limit to his money. Your children are starving. And if you had that $10,000, right, you would be able to feed your children. The man is senile, and he leaves the $10,000 on the table and leaves the room. He'll never know that you took it. No one will ever know. He doesn't need it. You need it desperately. In that scenario, if you could take the money, then you're a ganav. Except the circumstance has not yet presented itself where you feel comfortable stealing. But intrinsically, you're a thief. Because you could take something of somebody else if the circumstances were right. I'll tell you something maybe I shouldn't say, but especially maybe in a shul, but it brings out the point very nicely, and we'll try to say it in a respectable way. George Bernard Shaw was not known. He loved to irk society people. So he was once at a high-class party, especially in England, and he went to a high society matron and he said to her, will you have an affair with me? She looked at him like, you know, chutzpah, how could you even intimate such a thing, right? He said, what if I gave you $1 million? So she started to think. He said, okay, now that we've established your morals, let's establish a price. Meaning that if you could do it for $1 million, then intrinsically you're an immoral person. It's just a matter of what price will pay off for you to be immoral. Same thing over here. You're basically a thief, except the circumstances have not yet come where you feel comfortable stealing, but you could steal. And that is what's it called? Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitt says this. So what separates you between a person who has stolen? For him, the circumstances did come. For you, they didn't come. Everybody has different circumstances where they would feel comfortable stealing. But if you could steal in any circumstance, then you don't have good character. You just are controlling yourself, but you really haven't. Who has good character? Somebody who's worked on himself, and it's impossible for him to steal. There's no circumstance in the world that he would be able to steal because he's worked on his character and he has built himself into a person who's not capable of stealing. That's called good character. Otherwise, not good character. It's just like, you know what they say, Simcha Zissel from Kellum once made the following statement. He said that Darwin formulated the theory of evolution because he never saw a real human being. And therefore, the two-legged animals that he was familiar with could have come from other animals. But had he seen a real human being like my Rebbe, Rav Yisrael Salanter, he never could have formulated a theory that that human being came from an ape. Now, it's cute, but is it reasonable to say that Darwin never saw a real human being? What, he hung around, he swung from trees, right, eating bananas, and his friends were people who wore loincloths and guzzled turkey legs, right? What? Darwin's was a respectable person. His circle of friends were extremely refined, intellectual, respectable people. How could Simcha Zissel say that Darwin never saw a real human being? So I'll tell you what I think he meant. It's a famous story that was said about three different Gedolim: the Maral, the Rambam, and Rabbi Yonos and Apeshitz, which has me believe that it never happened to anybody. But it's a nice story. It's not Torah, it's a story, and therefore you don't have to believe that it ever happened. I'll tell you the story, Legavi the Rambam. Because in this week's Sedra, the Rav Naiman in Darchei Moshe brings down this story in the name of the Rambam, about the Rambam. The Rambam had a... The Rambam had a debate with a philosopher. The philosopher said you can train an animal to go against its instincts. And the Rambam says you can't. An animal is created with instincts and that's it. That's what it is. You can't change it. So the philosopher said, I'll prove to you I can. So he took 10 cats and he said, give me a few months. I'm going to train these cats to go against their instincts. Invites the Rambam to a banquet a few months later. Comes with a little box. The Rambam comes with a little box to the banquet. The philosopher takes out from his box a bell, rings the bell, and the cats come out of the kitchen dressed as waiters and waitresses with a towel over one arm and a tray, what's it called, standing on their hind legs, balancing trays, and serve the entree. The philosopher turns to the Rambam and says, look, I've trained these cats to walk on their hind legs against their instincts, to balance trays, to curtsy, to serve a meal. They're what's it called? Obviously, I've gone against their instincts. I've trained them to go against their instincts. The Rambam says, very nice, a long meal. Let's wait and see what happens. Nope, he rings his bell again. They come, serve the main course. Finally comes time for dessert. Before the philosopher rings his bell, the Rambam takes his little box, opens it up, and puts it on the floor. The philosopher rings his bell. The cats come out of the kitchen again. And all of a sudden there's pandemonium. The trays are being thrown all over and the cats are down on all four chasing the mice that the Rambam let loose. The Rambam turns to the philosopher. He says, you can train a cat to think he's a waiter all you want, but when the first mouse goes by, he remembers that he's a cat. And he's down on all fours chasing the mice. That's an animal. An animal, you cannot change its instincts. We also have instincts, but we're human beings. And the difference between a human being and an animal is not in degree. It's in kind. A human being has free choice and can change his instincts. He can conquer and control them even if the mice goes by. And mice come in all kinds of shapes and colors. He's somebody who's worked on their character can be in control no matter which mouse goes by. Somebody who hasn't worked on his character is basically a trained animal. An animal can also be trained to act respectfully and be a waiter. But he can't change his instincts. And if the mouse goes by, he's down on all four. A person who hasn't worked on his character can act respectfully up until the first mouse goes by. Once the first mouse goes by, that says Rav Naiman is what happened to Ephraim. Ephraim offers Avraham Avinu Maris Machpelah for free. Wow, magnanimous. And in the end, he ends up overcharging him in a terrible way. What happened? He said, what happened is, Avraham mentioned the word shekel. And Ephron was the mouse for Ephron was a shekel. And when the shekel went by, he couldn't control himself anymore. He heard money, that's it, he's finished. He's on down on all four. He could be very respectful till the shekel goes by. Everybody has their mouse. If you've worked on your character, and you have made yourself in total control, self-control, then no mouse in the world could ever put you on all fours. If you haven't, then you can be very respectful up until the time a mouse goes by. That's what Rav Simcha Zissel said. Darwin formulated the theory of evolution because he thought the difference between an animal and a human being is in degree. This is more respectful, more developed. And this is less, but they're the same thing. Had he ever, and because he never saw a real human being, he saw respectful people. He saw people who had good character, but nobody who ever worked on their character that no mouse could bring them down on all four. He saw people who never really were totally in control, and Mamela, they were no different than an animal, except they're a more respectful animal. So it's possible that this came from this. They're the same kind. Had he seen my Rebbe, Rav Yisrael Salanter, who did what no animal could ever do, became totally in control, and no mouse in the world could ever bring him down. He totally controlled his instincts. That's not a more developed animal, it's a different kind. This kind can't come from this kind, because an animal can never change its instincts, and a human being can, so they're not, how could it be the same thing? How could one come from the other? That's what he meant. So Mamela, someone who hasn't worked on their character, doesn't have good character, but it works the other way too. What's bad character? Somebody who's worked on his character to the point where he has inculcated within himself bad character traits. Somebody who just acts bad, but not inculcated within him, doesn't have any character. So sometimes this mouse pulls him this way, sometimes he can be respectful or whatever. But it's not that he has bad character or good character, he has no character. He just goes according to the time and place and instinct. Somebody who's worked on his character for the good has good character. Somebody who's worked on his character for the bad has bad character. Avraham Avinu said, my family, they're not good people. But it's not because they worked on themselves and developed bad characters. You know why it is? Because they live amongst people like that and they're influenced by the surroundings. That's why the Kli Yoker says, whenever it describes Lavan, it says, Lavan hu arami mipadan aram. You know why Lavan was a cheat? Because he lived amongst cheats. He didn't work on himself to become a cheat. He went along with the tide. The other people were cheats. He was a cheat too. Had he lived amongst good people, he would have been good. He didn't have any character, bad character or good character. He had no character. No character doesn't go on genetically, spiritually. I'm talking about spiritual genetics. Bad character does, good character does. The Knanim, on the other hand, really worked on their characters to make it rotten. I'll prove it to you. What did the Canaanim do? They didn't just do bad things. They did really bad things that you really had to be in total control evilly. I'll give you two examples. When their parents got old, so like people today, unfortunately, they looked at them as a burden. They're a burden on society, they're a burden on the family, right? So we got to get rid of them. So just today, they have, you know, legalized suicide, which is not really suicide, it's legalized murder, to get rid of these people who are a burden on the family and cost all this money and all this visiting time or whatever. So it's really not for the sake of the patients, for the sake of the people around. Then the people themselves feel guilty, why should I be a burden on my family? And that's usually what pushes them, because the family makes them feel like they're a burden. So that's already nice. They didn't like that, because just giving the guy something to commit suicide doesn't benefit anybody. It just takes away the burden. The Canaanim had a better idea. They fed their parents to their dogs when they got old and were a burden. Now that really takes bad character. Right? You can't just be a guy who's not in control to take your parents and feed them to your dog so you save a meal, right? And you also get rid of your parents. This is what was normal, right? Everybody had old parents. Okay, time for the dogs. They had other things too. It wasn't just the old people, the young people too. They took their children and they burned them to their gods. And they didn't burn them just like this. They threw them into a fire and that's it. You know, look the other way and hopefully that the gods are going to be appeased. It was much more than that. The priest stood over there and the father stood over here and he took his little child and he passed him over the fire slowly. And the priest passed him back. And they roasted the child slowly over the fire. Okay? If you have dreams tonight, don't blame me. You can't do that just because you're not a nice person. You have to really work on becoming a miserable person to be able to do something like that.
Or because you don't have Yirat Hashem.
Yeah, that's what starts it. But it's still, you need a lot of work to really be able to do that. Right? What? Right. And that's, that to be that evil, you have to have really bad character. Right? You have to be cruel. That's bad character traits. You have to be cruel. So you have to work on being cruel. It doesn't come naturally. These kind of things don't come naturally. Therefore, the Kenanim had bad character. Therefore, Avram was afraid it would pass on to generation. His family had no character. They didn't work on their characters to be bad or good. They just had no character. No character doesn't pass on, and therefore you can train people to have good character and replace their no character. But it's hard to uproot bad character and replace it with good character. That's what Avraham Avinu, that's what the Rambam is talking about. When he says that the Kenanim had bad character and that would pass on, and his family was only idol worshippers, but they didn't have bad character, it doesn't mean they were nice people. They were cheats and liars. But they weren't because they worked on themselves to become like that. It's just because they never worked on themselves one or the other, so they followed the tide of the people around them. And they didn't have Yerushalayim, so the mail, it was easy to do. But they never really inculcated within themselves bad character traits that would be passed on from generation to generation. That could be what they ran. Rivka like Rachel and Leah? Yeah. They also, right. They
had some good character without the...
Right. They, the Rivka, Rachel, Leah, they worked on themselves. They were tzaddikim. Yeah. That's why they were fit. They had to be educated a little bit more of what was proper and what was not. But basically, they're from a side of midos. That's what the test was. Test wasn't how many pages of Chumash she knew with the Mizrahis or whatever, right, Rivka. It was what kind of balas chesed she was. Is she the kind of person who's a good-hearted person, right, unlike her parents who were cheats, liars, and only looking what they could get, you know, from other people. She was willing to give. So that's the foundation of a good midos, chesed. That's what the test was. The rest of it, we can teach her. But let's just see if she has the basis of being a good person. That's the difference.
Yeah. It's very difficult to understand that when Avram came to Eretz Kanaan, he was impressed by the people.
Only in the fact he wasn't impressed with them. He was impressed with one thing about them, that they were willing to put in work now for a future benefit. And not people who just ate, drank, and were married. That's just, but they were rotten people. But in this respect, he saw that the land had that effect on them. Right? The land itself, the environment, that's what we explained last time, I think. The environment was that here you don't, and not everything is for immediate gratification. You can put in work for the future. Even the non-frum chalutzim, and that's an understatement, because they weren't just not frum, they were anti-religious, and they knew better. They were brought up in frum homes. Right? These are people who took a Sefer Torah from one of the kibbutzim that was saved from the Holocaust. Right after the Holocaust, they spread it out and shechted rabbits on it to eat. That's how anti-religious they were. Okay? So, but when they came here, they didn't come for immediate gratification. They cleared the swamps and they prepared the land for future generations, not for themselves. So there was something about the land here, the environment, that Avraham Avinu was impressed with. Not necessarily the people, but how the people were affected by the environment. But the people themselves were miserable people.